Welcome to the Clarity Fund Podcast. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and I'm joined again by Dr. Kelly Burton. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
We're doing a series together on the Academy and challenges facing the Academy. What will it take to get foundational truths in place on which to build the rest of the Academy? So we ended last time with that question, and it's a kind of analogy, right, to construction. You're building something, you want a solid foundation, because if the foundation cracks, the rest of the structure crumbles. And then we also were talking about looking at current challenges and thinking about how to best reply to them, because sometimes the answer people give is just turning back to tradition. Maybe we have to go back to Plato or Aristotle. And I think we're going to be doing something a little different than that. Now, before we began, you were telling me, Dr. Burton, about some of the things you're reading, which are very relevant for our current discussion. Why don't you tell us about those?
Yeah, I have been thinking about where the Academy is at today. And in my book, Retrieving Knowledge, I traced three strains of, philosophy in the Academy since the 1950s, let's say, maybe even the 1930s. I looked at the analytic tradition, and the analytics married themselves to science and have had a certain focus and project. And then I looked at the pragmatist tradition. And then I was looking at the Frankfurt School and critical theory. And that's what seems to be really popular right now. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out, how did that strain of philosophy in America, become the most popular?
Yeah.
And I've been trying to figure this out. And so I've been reading a lot about critical theory, and I'm reading this book right now called Critical Theory and Epistemology, The Politics of Modern Thought and Science by Anastasia Marinopoulou. It's interesting because the author makes the distinction between critical theory and several other continental branches of philosophy. And I think a lot of people just say postmodernism.
Yeah.
But she makes some very clear distinctions that I've been thinking about, and it helps me to see why critical theory is rising to the top. And I think this is key to what we're interested in.
Yep.
Let me give you some of the things she contrasts. I'm going to read a little summary here.
Yeah, please do.
She talks about phenomenology as a contrast to critical theory. And she thinks phenomenology never influences social rationality, whatever that is. I think it has to do with the structures of society. Bourdieu's view of reason and structures as an unexamined relation of science to the world. Basically, what's going to come out is that some of these philosophies don't talk about an ethical aspect of science. Deleuze's lack of potential for new politics, Foucault's critique of science deprived of any notion of dialectical rationality. The dialectic is going to be really important for the critical theorists.
Yeah.
Luhmann's systems theory, where the total eclipse of scientific reason prioritizes action and not the normativity of the sciences. And then lastly, she talks about Bhaskar's dialectics, which becomes relativistic through polyvalence, where anything goes in science, and consequently in society and politics, despite its initial political anxieties. Okay, so she's contrasting critical theory with these different strains of continental philosophy, and what I'm gathering is that these other strains of philosophy do not emphasize the social and political implications of science. Critical theory pays attention to that, and they use the dialectics as a method for exploring social structures. So I think that's why it's rising to the top, because of its application to science and society and technology.
And maybe science, particularly as the science of sociology.
Yes, the social sciences, yeah.
And so it's giving an account of change in terms of the dialectic, which in that sense is similar to Marx, the materialist dialectic. There's some distinctions,
yes,
here, and some people object when you say, this is Marxism. They'll say, no, it's not Marxism at all. So I'm simply saying, yeah, in terms of that dialectic and analyzing culture in terms of a basic conflict.
Yes, definitely conflict. Definitely the goal of liberation from oppression.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to, I should say economic conflict particularly.
That seems to have been the original intent. What I see the critical theorists doing is taking pieces from Marx, pieces from Nietzsche, pieces from Freud, and really doing something different than all of them. So I want to take critical theory on its own, as a philosophy, let's just say.
Yeah. Well, I think right now what's on my mind is Foucault, because I'm doing some work for him in a class that I'm teaching. And I worked on him in one of the chapters of my book, The Natural Moral Law.
Yeah.
And looking at how he analyzes change in civilization. So, for example, his book, Madness and Civilization. The category of madness and as the opposite of reason is in that dialectic. And
yes.
So in the quote you were just reading, you see that working, where what they mean by reason is practical rationality.
Yes.
And cultural rationality. I'll distinguish those. And cultural rationality means what a given culture accepts as rational norms. And when you're working in those, you're understood to be reasonable. And when you're not working in those, you're understood to be less and less reasonable until you might be considered insane. And so that's one sense of reason. Conventional, let's say it's the conventional use of reason, not the natural sense of reason in itself, which you and I have both worked on.
Right.
So Foucault doesn't get there, and it sounds like from the quote you read, they're not going to get there either, to reason itself. They're analyzing in terms of social structures, which are then, what they do is when it develops the sense of reason, it also creates its opposite, madness or insanity.
Right.
And non-reason.
Right.
Because you have that dichotomy, right? And so there's this conflict that goes on, and the self and the other is developed. So how would we understand, how would we relate to that? Because in one sense, yeah, that's true. Cultures have norms, and sometimes these norms may be more or less healthy. But that requires that there's some other standard that you're appealing to say, look, these norms aren't as healthy. They're not conducive to flourishing, because you're comparing it to some other standard.
Right. Right. I think my project for a number of years has been to trace what people mean when they say the word reason. And I think you're right to point out there's an instrumental use of reason here. I was reading an essay by Horkheimer this weekend too, called On the End of Reason, meaning the goal of reason. Mm-hmm. And he definitely takes reason to be a tool merely.
Yeah. It's probably practical instrument, rationality.
And it's almost as if society begins with a certain assumption, and reason as a tool is going to work itself out so that we reach the logical conclusion of that starting point. And the West has taken a bad turn, and now reason's working itself out. But the way to resist it is through the dialectic, like you were saying, with madness as maybe the other of reason, or letting the other voice speak as a counter to that sort of, it's not deterministic, but the way culture is unfolding because we started at a certain point needs to be halted by the other.
Yeah. Well, and that there's an arbitrariness to history, meaning precisely because these things aren't eternal norms. They're simply social constructs.
Right.
Some people are arbitrarily, not because of anything virtuous about them, put in situations where they're in a better position. And other people arbitrarily are born into situations where they're not in a position of power. And what's interesting is, though, that strikes this view, the proponents of this view, that strikes them as unfair. But that's a standard not built in. Where do we get the sense of fairness or injustice from?
That is a really good point. And this book is going to say that they accept certain things a priori.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be, I don't know, fairness is one of those a priori things you have to start with. Yeah.
Well, and I wonder too if there's a kind of impatience with those kinds of questions, because I've heard back from people who say things like, look, it doesn't matter. The theoretical structure doesn't matter. All that matters is we're helping people. We're making the world better. So you can sit around talking about your theoretical structures all the day, whereas I want to make things in the world more equitable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm hearing too. But the question is every inequality unjust?
Yeah. Well, also, I wanted to give an example back to the founding of America. And I look at this, this is another book plug, in my book on the Declaration of Independence. Because in the Federalist Papers, Madison talks about the need for checks and balances between different belief systems, precisely because if one, let's say political or religious, or the two he's thinking of, if one of those gets into power and doesn't have any checks, then it will become tyrannical. And so you need a system which allows for a kind of majority rule with protection for minority rights. So, for example, if let's say the Lutherans become the dominant religious view, you still want to have the Episcopalians' freedom of worship protected.
Yes.
So that's there. I don't want to attribute that idea of if we don't agree on things, when we haven't yet gotten to knowledge, we have to have a system in place which protects our pursuit of knowledge. That's how I interpret Madison.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, I don't think he provides us with the means for coming to knowledge. I think maybe what happened was they got stuck in that sense of skepticism, of saying, look, no one knows. We're all dealing with opinions. And so we're protecting our freedom to have opinions. Whereas I would call that an intermediate state. I would say that's the middle, where we don't know yet, while we're working towards agreement and knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think you're right. But can we talk a little bit about preserving that liberty that's needed to have this discussion?
Yeah, well, that's why, yeah, definitely. Because I think the change is Madison is looking at, I think he's getting more to the core than, say, a Marxist, because he's looking at our beliefs about the most important things to us, not only economics. We're not merely financial creatures. Indeed, you could have lots of money and be quite empty, and you could be poor but have fulfillment.
Yeah.
So that's one reason I brought him up, was to say, look, there is a sense of checks and balances. There is a need for liberty of conscience and the pursuit of what we believe is true. But it's more basic than economic issues.
Yes. Do you see that liberty being eroded today?
Well, it certainly seems to be threatened, but this is a good question about censorship and how it works. How do we determine if something is to be censored or not? Now, I tend to fall on the side of J.S. Mill of saying, let all ideas go at it in the public sphere, and those who are able to argue for their position will be the ones who prevail.
Yeah.
But what's happening is that opposition is being painted as in the worst light possible. And so then they'll say, look, since this opposition believes, and they'll attribute some terrible things to it, it shouldn't be allowed to speak.
I think there's a previous thing going on. You said, let all arguments, you know, be heard. I think we've undermined the ability to have arguments. That arguments are the way ideas are vetted. I think we've made it personal and about power.
Yeah.
So then it becomes sort of strong-arming one another rather than the arguments being sorted out.
Yeah, that's why I think precisely that Madison wanted to preserve was the ability to have those debates. I mean, that's what Congress does. People with different opinions get elected to go to Congress and debate each other. And that's what we can do in the area of religion also. We have the freedom to debate each other. So on any issue, the freedom that we're talking about is the freedom to present your argument and argue for it, which requires reason. But if we've adopted a view of the human as essentially an animal, then we will shift to saying humans aren't primarily rational, they're primarily appetites. And that's economics, desire.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been thinking about this thing called cancel culture.
Yeah.
I was told recently that's not a thing, but I think it is. And I think cancel culture. Canceling people is bypassing this conversation that needs to be had, and it's dehumanizing.
Yeah, you want to figure out, because I've heard that applied in a few different settings in different ways, so you have to figure out exactly which one of the kinds we're talking about.
I can give you an example. I heard about this music theorist professor in Texas who wrote in a scholarly journal against a certain presentation, and it was about music theory, but because this author was denying that a person was racist when the presenter said he was racist and this person said he wasn't, marshaled out really great arguments. I read it this morning, and he was basically denounced as supporting a racist. So where we usually have these academic discussions in scholarly journals, a back and forth, they're just being terminated.
Yeah. No more discussion about those things.
Right. And not just that, the guy's job might be in jeopardy.
Well, there's certain things, for example, that are agreed upon important values. I don't think anybody in our society would disagree that things like love and justice are important. No matter what side of the spectrum you're on, no one goes around saying, I don't like justice or I don't like love.
Right.
But once you've got that term on your side and you can say of the other person, they don't like justice, that's so shocking that you say to yourself, well, wow, they don't like justice. Why would I want to listen to them? So
right.
It's an argumentative tool, a debating tool, but it's not, quote unquote fair in the sense that, of course, the other person thinks that they're promoting justice. No one disagrees about that. And we don't need to attribute those motives to each other. There's plenty of things that we can debate and argue about without doing that.
So what is what's our proposal for going ahead in this contentious and politically charged public discussion?
Well, so let's start to break the ice about reason. We've both pointed out that when the term is used, it's very ambiguous.
Yeah.
And in the history of thought, it usually divides into two things: speculative rationality and practical rationality. And
yep.
Practical rationality can have cultural dimensions to it so that it is shaped and then used to put others on the margins. And so therefore, when someone's arguing against reason, we can't hear them necessarily as arguing against reason in itself as the laws of thought. They're arguing against a certain use of practical rationality.
Yeah.
So when I say break the ice, what I mean is let's notice that and say, nevertheless, there's something else going on for humans, which is that they're forming beliefs. And wherever you find yourself in a given society, I think both Sartre and Jim Morrison said, into this world we're thrown. You just find yourself in the world. But wherever you find yourself, and let's say you're disadvantaged in your culture because of how it shapes practical rationality, you're able to form beliefs, nevertheless, about the most important things that exist. And that's something about you that can't be taken away, and that's something about you can always do. In fact, we have some people that we look up to. For example, I can think of three off the top of my head: Socrates, Boethius, and John Bunyan, who all ended up in prison when they were doing some of their best work.
Yeah.
So that's pretty disadvantaged. Socrates had an unfair trial and had to accept the death penalty because he didn't want to stop thinking. So we want to break the ice by saying, look, we're not considering reason in its fullness. And when we do that, reason becomes a source of skepticism. And so even the best among us who do have very important and valuable critiques to be made are nevertheless struggling with getting reason in focus. And I think you and I have been doing enough work on that where we can help with that.
Yeah, I think that's maybe something unique that we can contribute is to say, hey, let's stop and think, what do we mean by reason here? And let's work it through and see how we're using that word.
Yeah, and we might trace it back to Kant.
I think
critical theory gets half of its name from Kant.
Yep.
And his critique philosophy, critique of pure reason even. But and you see in Kant that dichotomy I mentioned earlier between speculative and practical rationality. He calls it pure rationality. So he has a critique of pure rationality and a critique of practical rationality. And so we're going to have to probably go back, and maybe that's where we pick up next time, go back and look at Kant and the modern project.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
We should do that.
I think we both would say, in some ways, the modern project failed, and in other ways, it raised important questions for the tradition.
Right. And I think that's really the bright side of this cultural moment, is that it is helping us to see where things went wrong in that modern project.
Yeah.
And it makes us all more conscious, and it helps us to see what we can do to lay a better foundation.
Well, that's why I appreciate, actually, some of these thinkers we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they bring into question reason, and what they show is that in the name of reason, you haven't gotten to meaning.
Yep.
And so I think that's a very valuable thing to point out. And I call that, I've written that we're living in an age of skepticism, but it's an in-between age. In one way, it's not even an age. It's the time in between ages. And that requires us to go back and see where we didn't get the foundation in place. And we must use that, must take advantage of that time to make sure we do that.
Yeah, what a wonderful time to live and do philosophy.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting.
Yeah,
so that's why
we
say, well, do we have liberty threatened, or do we have difficulties in the academy? Sure, but we also have a lot of great opportunities to raise very important questions and discuss them together.
In public, like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, concluding today's episode and anticipating next time, where we can look at the philosophy of critique, beginning with Kant. Thank you all for joining us and being part of our conversation.
Thank you. I always appreciate talking with you, Dr. Anderson.